Good morning. The Arizona Board of Behavioral Health Examiners will now come to order. It is 9 a.m. on November 5th, 2021. We have a roll call, please.
Kimberly Bailey.
Present.
Robert Charles.
Here.
Mary Coonrod.
Present.
Cedric Davis.
Good morning.
Patricia Dobratz.
Here.
Lynette Hennigan.
Here.
Megan Kramer.
Here.
Cassandra Parr.
Present.
Mark Shen.
Present.
Gerald Szymanski.
Present.
Antoine Trotter.
Present.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Patricia Dobratz. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist and the board's chairperson. At this time, I'd like to ask everybody again to make sure that your cell phones are set to silent. Throughout the meeting, if anybody needs to use the restrooms, they are out in the lobby across from the elevators, and there are also vending machines across from the boardroom to your left. This is an open meeting, and it is being recorded. The audio from the meeting will be posted to the board's website. As such, we appreciate everyone's assistance in speaking clearly and into the microphones. At this point, I would ask the board members and board staff to introduce themselves, starting with Mr. Charles, please.
Bob Charles, public member.
Cassandra Parr, professional member.
Antoine Trotter, public member.
Hennigan, professional member.
Gerald Szymanski, professional member.
Kimberly Bailey, professional member.
Doc Davis, professional member, secretary, treasurer of the board.
Mark Shen, professional member.
Mary Coonrod, public member.
Megan Kramer, public member.
Aaron Yabu, deputy director.
Alyssa Vanderveen, operations manager.
Ian Hermand, assistant director.
Toby Zavala, executive director.
Mona Baskin, assistant attorney general, representing the board. Good morning.
Thank you, everyone. First, go to agenda item number 3, our review of minutes. And 3A are our September 10th general meeting minutes. Ms. Kramer, Mr. Szymanski, and Dr. Hennigan need to abstain from that vote. But otherwise, is there a motion to accept the meeting minutes?
Davis moves it.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. For the October 8th general meeting minutes, so that's 3B and 3C, our executive session minutes. Mr. Charles, Ms. Kramer, and Ms. Parr need to abstain from that vote. Otherwise, is there a motion to approve the general meeting minutes and the executive session meeting minutes?
Davis moves it.
Potter, second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. That will take us to our agenda item number 4, which is our consent agenda. For everybody's information, unless somebody is here to pull a case from the consent agenda, and what I mean by that is that you wish to actually speak to the matter, then we will vote on the consent agenda as it appears. So I'm going to read the cases just to see who is here to pull them, and then we'll go back through them as needed. So 4A are our cases recommended for dismissal. 4A1 is Mr. Blocker, and I believe that's being pulled by the complainant via phone. Is Mr. Blocker present? Okay. A2, Kristen Elliott. Is there anybody here to pull that matter? A3, Kristen Pulver. I believe that is being pulled. Is that correct? Is the, and you're the complainant? Is the licensee present? All right. And then for A4, Sonia Stopper-Hagan. Is there anybody here to pull that matter? All right. Is there a motion to dismiss A2 and 4?
Davis moves it.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. All right, and then we will go to 4A1. Mr. Blocker, if you want to come forward. And I believe we're going to get the complainant on the phone. And Mr. Blocker, if you press the microphone, it should turn on.
I can help you.
Is this Ms. Edwards?
Yes, it is.
Hi, Ms. Edwards. This is Patricia Dobratz. I am the Arizona Board of Behavioral Health Examiners chairperson.
Hi. How are you?
Good morning. I am doing well. We just called the matter in which you're the complainant. And just to give you an idea, it is myself and the remaining board member and our board members, along with the licensee and board staff. It is a public meeting, so everything is being recorded. We're first going to hear a brief summary from board staff. This is on the consent agenda recommended for dismissal. You will then have up to 5 minutes to address the board, and then the licensee will have up to 5 minutes to address the board if he wishes. We do have all of the materials in the matter, so we ask that you not repeat anything, but if there's additional information, you can do so. So I'd ask that you mute your phone while we hear from board staff.
Okay.
Following a review of the investigative record, there does not appear to be clear and convincing evidence to support the complainant's allegations, and that's all I have unless you have questions for me.
Are there questions from board members? Ms. Edwards, as I mentioned, you now have up to 5 minutes to address the board.
Okay, thank you. I do not, I have a copy of the investigation, so as far as not repeating, I'm not sure I may repeat. I guess you guys could tell me. Basically, this was just brought to my attention as I served the family, and everything that was shared with me was that the licensee had abused the client as well as his siblings sexually. And the concern is that, I mean, one, abuse, of course, for children, but secondly, that he was a clinician and still serving children per his website. That is, I mean, those are the, I guess, major concerns is the danger that other children or adolescents could be in and the impact that it has had on this client as well as the overall family.
Thank you.
And,
go ahead.
Sure. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, sorry, I lost my track of I wasn't sure that I was going to be able to present this morning, so I'm a little caught off guard. Based on what I had seen and there hadn't been a response. So I'm sorry that I'm not completely prepared. I was trying to pull up the information that I had. But again, the information was shared to me as I was serving the family, a parent coaching role. The client has many diagnoses, and most, I guess, recent when the complaint was made was there were a lot of overly sexualized behaviors. It seems like addiction to porn. There was a sexual assault on another child. And since this child I know has been unfortunately placed in foster care. But again, this family, from what I understand, has made these allegations before, and it just seems that there has been nothing that the alleged abuser has not been held accountable or been able to respond to that for them. So that's how the complaint was filed.
Thank you. Do board members have any questions for Ms. Edwards? Mr. Bacher, you have up to 5 minutes to address the board if you'd like to as well.
I have nothing to say.
Are there questions from board members for the All right. At this time, it is our chance to deliberate amongst ourselves, so we ask that you not interrupt. And I believe
it was, yeah. So this one was pretty clear to me. So after reviewing the board's report today, I agree with the board's findings that there's no clear convincing evidence for unprofessional conduct, and I recommend that we dismiss.
Second?
I second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Ms. Edwards, we thank you for being available this morning, and this will conclude this matter. Thank you, Mr. Blocker, for being here as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Turn this off?
Yep. Thank you. All right, and we will go to 4A3, Kristen Pulver. Again, is the licensee here? Okay. I shouldn't have let him turn off the microphone. I apologize. You can turn that in. Out of respect for your privacy, we'll refer to you by your initials, RC. And same format. We're going to hear from board staff, and then you'll have a chance to address the board.
Board Chair, members of the board, based on the licensee's 1/20/21 court appointment in this matter, the board may consider dismissing the complaint pursuant to ARS 3232-81-D1, which gives the board the authority to dismiss complaints that are without merit. Complaints dismissed pursuant to this section cannot be disclosed by the board as a complaint on the licensee's complaint history. In addition to this, it does not appear that psychotherapy services were provided. And that's all I have, unless you have questions for me.
Do board members have any questions? As the complainant, you have up to 5 minutes to address this now.
I want to preface this by thanking you all for your time. I will be brief. I'm well aware that the presence today will not result in any disciplinary action against Kristen Pulver, as amnesty is provided to court-appointed advisors. My only hope in coming here today is to educate you all on the critical importance of doing your due diligence, even when such doesn't impact your licensure, because it still impacts children. My name is Rachel Cardona. I am a behavioral health counselor, the proud mother of 5 beautiful little boys, and a domestic violence survivor. In 2019, I fled my hometown of Cleveland, Ohio, after having been granted a disillusion from my abuser. The terms of such being that in exchange for the freedom of myself and my children, I agreed to clear my ex-husband of any and all financial responsibility for the children. I agreed to sign the house over to him and forfeit any equity. I would just have my children and my freedom, and that was more than enough for me. Nearly 2 years later, after relocating to Arizona, my destitute ex-husband sought to force the children out of return. When he realized that I was not going to return, that I had empowered myself and was supporting my children, we were thriving, he became very enraged and sought to then utilize the court system. At this point, Kristen Pulver was assigned to assess the situation and decide what was in the best interest of my children. I was fully transparent. I provided all requested documentation, photos of their room, proof that they were doing well. In addition to that, the history of the abuse, including the validated active order of protection that I had currently, because there was a witness interaction where my ex-husband had stated that he intended to come to Arizona to kill me. Following the rescheduled digital interview of the three of the four children, Ms. Pulver submitted her report just hours before the scheduled court date. In it, she alleged that my children were coached, citing her belief that my children were, quote, too well spoken. I am a proud graduate of Hampton University, in addition to having my master's degree. My children are empowered, and they are able to use their words as little black boys, and that's a shock to people, and that was used against my babies. Ms. Pulver stated that the boys were suffering from parental alienation due to them expressing their reluctance to go visit with their father, who they hadn't seen in almost 2 years, and that prior to that they had witnessed brutally beating their oldest brother and myself on a daily basis. Ms. Pulver's report ultimately determined our case, and my abuser was given joint custody of my children with a week on, week off. Immediately, I was ordered to hand my children over for an entire week, and during such time, I had no contact with them, despite the fact that I did my due diligence in sending them their phone. Shortly after this, one of my children had an emotional breakdown. I took him to Phoenix Children's Hospital. He was given a diagnostic assessment, and he was shown to have anxiety, depression, and an adjustment disorder. We had to do further testing, and he was shown to have enuresis, stress-induced enuresis as well, because there was nothing physically wrong with him. He was prescribed and told to receive counseling. But because of the order Ms. Kristen Pulver suggested that everything be joint, I had to go to my ex-husband and request that I be able to give my child counseling. He denied it. His reason being, quote, no one needs to know what goes on in my house. I went back to court and requested the judge make a redetermination to allow me to have the ability to provide services for my child. And I was told, Kristen Pulver is an expert, and if she says it's parental alienation, and I was not granted that. Following this happening, my children continued to go over there. The same child had a 16-minute seizure and was transported by ambulance to the hospital, where he and I remained together for 2 days, given a full gamut of testing and shown that he does not have epilepsy. This continued onward. Following this incident taking place, I went back to the court again and again, most recently in September, because my children revealed to their school during the time, the week that he had them, they went to their school and revealed that he had begun physically abusing them just as he abused myself and my eldest son. They had bruises, knots in their head, all of their injuries substantiated all of their account. I went back to the court again and was again told, Kristen Pulver is an expert, and if she says it's parental alienation, it's parental alienation. Following this, I just want my moment. Following this, my ex-husband was found on the 21st of September in the parking lot after having followed me into my job, and he was found in the parking lot by the police waiting for me with a loaded weapon. I had that here. I went back to court again and said, this man is in a school, I work in a school, with a loaded weapon in the parking lot waiting for me after having chased me in the building by Glendale police. And I was told once again, Kristen Pulver says it's parental alienation, so it's parental alienation. My straight-A students are now all struggling academically. Previously, they were straight-A students. They've now experienced starvation, wake up wet, screaming for me. All this could have been prevented by simply doing your due diligence. She wasn't compelled to do her due diligence. I provided her all the documentation. I gave her everything, and it was ignored. And I truly believe it was because she knew that this would not go against her licensure. So thank you so much for hearing me. I hope my story will impact each of you. And going forward, if anybody provides these services, I beg of you, provide them with the same equity and quality and continuity of care as you would if it went against your license. I'm fighting for my children's life right now, and if somebody had just done their due diligence, my babies would be safe. So please, thank you.
I don't need to see if any board members have any questions for you.
I have a question. How did she come about being your court appointed?
When my ex-husband came, he ended up following us from Cleveland here. The case was opened up here, and the judge assigned her as the court-appointed advisor in our case. So she was assigned by the judge.
Okay. Right, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. This will be our time to talk amongst ourselves.
Yes.
Can I ask a legal question first? No, I can ask it in public, okay. Legal advice in public. Because we're not going to hear from the licensee, right? So we're just...
Not here.
Okay. So this is recommended for dismissal based on the court appointment. But if the court appointment is based on the licensee being licensed, how do we not have authority to do that?
Mr. Szymanski, is that addressed to me?
Yes.
Yes, that would be a question for executive session for legal advice and to review confidential records.
Can I make a motion to go into executive session, please?
Is there a second?
Second.
Favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
We will go back into open session at 9:36, and we will resume our deliberation.
Thank you. First, I'd like to say thank you for your bravery. I understand it's difficult. Based on the information that we have and the facts that we have and understanding jurisdiction, I agree with the recommendation and move for dismissal. If you're ready.
Second?
I'll second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Nay.
Nay.
Can we do a roll call, please?
Kimberly Bailey?
Aye.
Robert Charles?
Nay.
Mary Coonrod?
Aye.
Cedric Davis?
Aye.
Patricia Dobratz?
Nay.
Lynette Hennigan?
Aye.
Megan Kramer?
Aye.
Cassandra Parr?
Aye.
Mark Shen?
Aye.
Gerald Szymanski?
Nay.
Antoine Trotter?
Nay.
Passed. Thank you for being here. And that will conclude 4A. We will go to consent agenda 4C. Our case is recommended for release from consent agreement. I'm assuming, but I'll read them aloud, that nobody is here to pull these. We have Ms. Gallagher, Ms. Heim, Ms. Martin, Ms. Rolles. Anybody here to pull those matters? All right. Is there a motion to release from the consent agreement?
Davis moves it.
Is there a second?
Chen, second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. For D, Ayala, I can't say it.
Ayala.
Thank you. Is the licensee present? All right. This is on our agenda to consider opening a complaint and accepting the proposed signed non-disciplinary consent agreement.
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Sorry. For 4D, our case is recommended for opening a complaint and accepting the proposed signed non-disciplinary consent agreement.
I have nothing to add.
Are there any questions? All right. Mr. Trotter?
Given the evidence, I motion that we open the complaint and accept the NDCA.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? And that will conclude our consent agreement.
I'm going to break, please.
Yes. We are going to take a break. It is 9:39. We'll come back at 9:45, please. We are going to go back on the record. It is 9:44. My understanding, we need to go back to consent agenda item number 4A2. Ms. Elliott? My understanding was it was not going to be pulled, but I misunderstood. You'd like to pull the matter. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. If you'd like to come forward, please. Is there a motion to rescind the motion to dismiss for the Ms. Elliott matter?
Davis moves it.
Trotter second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? And I believe we need to get the licensee and her attorney on the phone. Is that correct? And you're the complainant in this matter, correct? Okay.
Welcome to Lumen Conferencing. Thank you. Your passcode is confirmed. When you hear the tone, you will be the third person to join the meeting.
Ms. Elliott, Mr. Akins?
Yes, we're here.
All right. This is Patricia.
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you. This is the board's chairperson. And the matter has been pulled from the consent agreement, or from the consent agenda. We will hear a brief summary from board staff, and then I'll give the complainant a chance to address us, and then the two of you will have a chance to address us if you'd like as well. We do have all of the matters in all of the materials for this matter, but if there's anything additional, you'll have a chance to address us. I would ask that you...
Very good.
Thank you. I would ask that you mute your phones in the meantime. And Ms. Savalas?
Following a review of the investigative record, there does not appear to be clear and convincing evidence to support the complainant's allegations.
Are there questions?
Excuse me. I have a hearing impairment.
Oh, sorry. Ms. Zavala, can you repeat that and speak up into the mic?
Following a review of the investigative record, there does not appear to be clear and convincing evidence to support the complainant's allegations.
Thank you. Do board members have any questions for Ms. Zavala? As the complainant, you have up to 5 minutes to address us.
Well, I'm uncertain what concrete evidence you're seeking, but when there's a record of habitual abuse of the petitionary process because an individual cannot get their needs met in a timely manner, and then there is a response, a person is abused by a clinical team, and then you're going to abuse your power and use it as an element of control by using the petitionary process, and then furthermore using the judicial system to impose injunctions of a harassment and protections for something, an allegation that was never even reached. Ms. Christensen, Ms. Elliott, rather, suggested that she was threatened by a black man. I would like all of you to know I don't know Ms. Christensen any more than I know any of you. I've never seen her. I've only spoke with her over the phone while she was verbally abusive. At this point, I was advised or informed that my case was going to be moved. I was not informed about this. I never gave consent to it or anything else. Then I was subjected to a series of phone calls telling me what they were going to do. I had informed Ms. Elliott or Dominique, I believe, at the time who she had communicating with me that this was going to go forward, that if I had any more communication from this office, I was going to file an injunction of harassment. That's where she got the idea of filing an injunction of harassment and petitioning me. By doing so, in fact, I wasn't even considered retaliation. It was the psychiatrist at the observation unit who called it retaliation when she heard my story. So if I don't know what basis you have dismissed it, but what I will suggest is if it's that easy for someone with an associate's license to take that kind of control that is disruptive to an individual's life as it was to mine, I suggest that puts persons, consumers in a very high-risk area. Okay. So the only thing I can prove is the negation of my request for crucial records that Social Security Administration had requested. Months, weeks had went by. Those records are still not obtained. Social Security has no care about why they don't have the information that they requested. What they know is that they didn't have it. So I was subjected to that. When I brought up the issue of my housing that was placed at risk because of this negated request, then this became problematic for the entire clinical team. Then they had a sense of loss of control because then I started to advocate for myself. If you don't understand my sense of outrage because it placed my housing at risk, and then you don't understand that level of agitation, but you're going to use the petitionary process to control that individual, then furthermore, make up allegations that you were threatened and then use the judiciary process to do so, I think that puts people like me in a very high risk of abuse. So malfeasance was definitely imposed on me. So, it's unclear to me what criteria you're using to dismiss her case. What I do know is I have worked for that organization, and that same maneuver was directed to me by my coordinator to get rid of a client. So I would have to strongly suggest, that's a culture within that organization.
Do board members have any questions for
this? Not one.
We do have 274 pages of materials in this matter, so we have reviewed the materials. I can assure you of that. I'm now going to give the licensee and her attorney up to 5 minutes to address the board, as I gave you, and then it'll be our time to deliberate after that.
Okay. Now, in terms of the cultural competence that I was asked about by an investigator, I cannot prove the racial I cannot prove the allegation that I launched against her. In terms of the language that she used with me. But I do know the language I used with her was quite offensive. Her verbal abuse did not stop until I called her out of her name.
Thank you. We appreciate the additional information. Mr. Akins, you and your client have up to 5 minutes to address the board now.
Very good. Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Dr. Farron Akins. I'm counsel for your licensee, Kristen Elliott. We actually have no further information to provide. I think the 245 pages that board staff and board members have reviewed states amply our position. And so unless you have questions, which, of course, we're happy to address, we have nothing further to add to the matter at this time.
Do board members have any questions for the licensee?
I have a question.
I'm sorry. This is our time for the licensee and the board to communicate, and then it's going to be our time to deliberate. So I've given you your allocated time to address the board, but procedurally now it's our time to discuss amongst ourselves. No questions for the licensee? Okay. This will be our time to talk amongst ourselves. We ask that you not interrupt. Mr. Akins, I ask that you mute your phone again. And Dr. Shen, I believe this is just for you.
So, thank you. First, I want to acknowledge and thank Mr. Ulrich for being here today and providing that information. After reviewing the board reports, I agree with the board's findings that there is no clear and convincing evidence of unprofessional conduct. And I recommend that we dismiss.
There a second.
Bailey, second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. This will conclude this matter. We do appreciate you being here, Mr. Akins, and Ms. Elliott, we appreciate you being available as well. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you. Bye now.
Thank you.
Now go to agenda item number 7. This is our complaints and disciplinary matters. This is the time and place scheduled for board's review of disciplinary matters. They will be heard by the board pursuant to the authority given to us by ARS 323281. Please be aware that we have read all of the materials for each matter. During the course of the meeting, if it is necessary to refer to clients, including if the complainant is a client or former client, please use initials only. Those licensees or applicants on today's agenda received by mail a board meeting notice, which included a list of potential actions the board could take once we reach the deliberations phase. This list is not exclusive, and there may be other options the board considers. The board will first hear a brief summary of the case from its staff. Once staff is done, other interested parties, including the complainant, if applicable, and the professional will be given an opportunity to address the board. In order to give everyone the same opportunity to address the board, we ask those speaking not take time repeating information the board's already received. You and your legal counsel, if applicable, collectively will be given the same amount of time it took the board staff to present its case, or 5 minutes, whichever is greater. The board has a civility policy that prohibits the use of any type of disorderly conduct. Anybody violating that policy will be removed from this meeting room. Once the board concludes its discussion with all the parties, we'll move into our deliberations. Everybody is free to stay and listen. We respect the fact that this is our time to talk amongst ourselves and that you not interrupt. We will first go to 7A, Christina Aguilar. Mr. Carey, I believe you are representing the licensee.
That's correct.
If you both would introduce yourselves to the record, please.
Good morning, Flynn Carey, counsel for Ms. Aguilar.
Good morning, Christina Aguilar.
And board staff.
I'm sure members of the board, there was a supplement of information that was uploaded to the member portal yesterday, so if you hadn't had an opportunity to review that, you might want to do that while I go through the analysis. Ms. Aguilar is currently on an ICA, so today she's here to ask for release from an ICA. There's a lot of information in the analysis that would be information that we'd want to go into executive session, so I'm going to skip that part. It may or may not be that you have questions or concerns and you want to go into executive session, so please be cognizant of that moving forward. Following review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 3232516L, engaging in any conduct, practice, or condition that impairs the ability to licensee to safely and competently practice the licensee's profession. This recommendation is based on the following. Per the 620 consent agreement, licensee's LPC license would be suspended for 12 months, and licensee would be required to attend therapy twice monthly for 12 months. Therapist was required to submit quarterly reports to the board, and within the 421 quarterly report, therapist reported that licensee admitted to substance abuse for the past couple of months. Following conversations with board staff, licensee agreed to sign a proposed interim consent agreement suspending her license until such time as she came back to the board and established that she was safe and competent to practice psychotherapy. In 5/17/21, the board accepted the proposed signed interim consent agreement to suspend licensee's license. Since being placed on the initial consent agreement and interim consent agreement with the board, licensee has engaged in several forms of treatment to help with her sobriety and mental health. From 3/16/21 to 4/29/21, licensee participated in inpatient treatment with the Meadows. A 4/29/21 psychiatric discharge summary included that licensee appeared to maintain motivation to refrain from substance use, and licensee's thoughts are linear and goal-directed with coherent associations. From 4/28/21 to 5/18/21, licensee participated in a partial hospitalization program with Desert Star Addiction Recovery Center. From 5/17/21 to 7/19/21, licensee engaged in intensive outpatient services with the Meadows. Licensee's discharge summary from the Meadows IOP indicated licensee presented as high functioning with good attendance, appropriate feedback, and completion of homework assignments. From 7/22/21 to 8/16/21, licensee participated in IOP services with Desert Star Addiction Recovery. Since 8/2/21, licensee has been attending outpatient services with the Wellbeing Institute. And on 8/18/21, licensee submitted a written request to be released from her ICA. With licensee's request to be released from the ICA, she provided her 4/10/21 relapse prevention plan, which included the following in part. Licensee's motivation to recover comes from a desire to live a life congruent with her morals and integrity and to be present for her daughter. Licensee wants to be able to return to her profession as a counselor with healthy self-care and boundaries. Licensee identified numerous triggers and warning signs to look for and what she can do when she notices these triggers and warning signs. Licensee will engage in self-care activities, follow a schedule, attend 12-step meetings, and focus on the Serenity Prayer. Licensee's reasons for following this plan is her recovery is her first priority. If licensee maintains her recovery, then her life will be balanced and she will be able to accomplish her goals. The health, well-being, and love of her daughter means everything to licensee. Licensee wants to set a good example for her daughter. Licensee can survive anything if she stays sober. Accountability partner submitted a letter, and in that letter, the accountability partner is optimistic about the future path of licensee's recovery, and licensee has made great progress to date in her recovery. Licensee provided a letter from her physician dated 9/17/21, which indicated the following. Since beginning services with physician, licensee has been meeting regularly with individual therapists, attending group therapy sessions multiple times a week, and has been keeping up with appointments with her psychiatric provider. Every one of licensee's urine samples have been negative for illicit substances, and licensee has never tried to avoid providing a sample. It is a physician's professional opinion from his interactions with licensee and observation regarding licensee's behavior that licensee's been doing well at this time and putting forth real honest effort into maintaining her sobriety. And that's all I have for you unless you have any questions. And just as a reminder, be cognizant of the behavioral health issues that are in the report.
Board members have any questions? Mr. Carey, you have up to 5 minutes to address the board as well.
Thank you, Chair Dobratz, members of the board. In the question and answer section, we'll take our cues from you. If we do start going down a road that may require that, we're very comfortable doing that in an executive session, but we'll obviously we can stop at that point and have that conversation. I'll just briefly address the more technical or legal sides of this. We're here to request a release from the ICA, and we're asking for a modification of the underlying consent agreement or a revised consent agreement that allows her to go to work in a controlled way. As the board's aware, she was under a consent agreement, and it contained a one-year suspension, which she has participated in, and she largely complied with the terms of her agreement, which was education, counseling, ethics, along those lines. She is now seeking to have her case transitioned, and I think that you've now received in the supplements yesterday and in previous supplements, every provider with whom she is working has said that she is fit to practice now. So I do think there is a unanimous agreement among her providers as recently as 2 days ago and yesterday from the Wellbeing Institute that she is safe to practice. We also have a provider, Dr. Cabianca, who is willing to supervise her and is very familiar with the entirety of this case. And so we do have someone who's obviously a healthcare professional, a mental health care professional himself, but also someone who knows of Ms. Aguilar's background. I think with the records that you received, if you look at them from start to finish, you have someone who comes in crisis, and every time they hit a next stopping point in their treatment, they do two things. The providers note two things: improved condition, and then they make treatment plan recommendations. And Ms. Aguilar, in response, follows those conditions, and when she's discharged from the next program, another improved condition, and we have just continued to go down that road. So I do think this is someone who is being very successful. I also think she's been tested now. Her father passed away recently, and instead of engaging in behaviors that were inappropriate or that were destructive, she actually used her education, her training, her recovery, and did the right things to be able to stay sober. And so I think she's already been tested, and she's been put through some things recently and shown that she's still very worthy of a chance to return to work. I'll cede the rest of the time to Ms. Aguilar, but we would ask that you consider removing the ICA and coming up with a consent that is appropriate under the circumstances to allow her to return to work.
Members of the board, I really want to thank you and appreciate this opportunity to meet with you today to discuss my progress. I am requesting to transition from the interim consent agreement necessary while I was in treatment to a new agreement which reflects the current stage I am at in my recovery. I am extremely grateful for the patience and support that has been extended to me, the thoughtful consideration of my circumstances, and the collaborative efforts the board staff has extended to ensure I receive the guidance and services I needed to help me through a very difficult time in my life. When I first received the investigative report, it was daunting, and I was quite honestly scared to open it. But I have learned in the process of my recovery the importance of facing life on life's terms, and taking an honest and open inventory of myself is essential if I'm to learn and grow. I have reviewed all of the materials of the investigative report. While it was initially painful to see over 600 pages of information, what struck me was the amount of dedication and meticulous attention to detail that has been taken to carefully gather all the information on my behalf. I went through those materials, and insight started to override my fear. I did see the progression from where I started to where I am today, and I am proud that I am 7 months and 16 days clean and sober. I now see those progress notes, reports, letters, and opinions as living proof that with tough love, hard work, humility, and the willingness to face one's fears, resolution and recovery is very possible. These pages are testimony to the grace that comes with surrender. I have come out of these stages of the treatment process a better person, a better daughter, a better mother, and a better professional. What struck me from the reports is how often in the early stages of my treatment that I felt lost, directionless, and yet unable to ask for help. I was in constant conflict with myself. I didn't know what I was supposed to be doing, and equally afraid that for some reason I was supposed to know everything. And while that internal chaos created paralyzing anxiety, the denial presented itself as arrogance and entitlement. Through my recovery process, I now know that these efforts to protect my vulnerability paradoxically made me susceptible to internal and external negative influences that a healthy me would have not given attention to. My treatment has taught me a lot, but two things in particular. It has taught me that it's okay not to have all the answers and that uncertainty does not mean I need to fall apart. Recovery has presented an opportunity for me to lean into my supports that much more. I have been able to grieve these losses with the healthy support of my recovery family, my treatment team, my sponsor, my accountability partner, and my faith in this process. I understand also that while I have had so many times in my life allowed other people to question my value, I have done so as well. I see now how destructive that type of thinking is, and I am extremely fortunate to have new ways of dealing with adversity, approaching uncertainty, and coping with my own insecurities and shortcomings. I am excited to be here with you all today because I've worked hard to earn your time and to share where I'm at in my recovery process. I am additionally very, very fortunate to have the support and mentorship of Dr. Leonard Kavianka, who I have known and maintained a working relationship with since I began my internship in counseling with Job Corps in 2012. I have been blessed with his guidance and with the opportunity for employment under his direction that I am respectfully requesting from you today. Dr. Kabianka is fully aware of my background and history, and with all this in mind, is willing to give me an opportunity to return to the profession I love with support and supervision. I know that this has been a long path for me. I hope that you are able to see not just the problems, but the process and consistent progress, and will continue to provide your mindful support and believe in me and my potential. I hope that you are also able to take into careful consideration the recommendations of my recovery team that I am ready to move forward and have the tools I need to advance to this next stage of my journey. Thank you so much.
And Ms. Zavala, Mr. Carey, Aguilar, my understanding is Dr. Kabianka is available via phone if board members have any questions.
That is correct.
Board members have any questions for...
I guess the only question that I have, I don't know, maybe you'll answer this, just what type of work you would be doing at Job Corps?
So Job Corps, as you might know, is a program that works with underserved or disadvantaged young people of 18 to 25. And so it would be light counseling, more like support services, group counseling, helping them with their esteem and their efficacy, vocational training and the such. So what I would consider light counseling.
Training.
Yes.
So it's not a heavy substance-related or anything like that?
No. No, sir, not at all. They do live there, but they, if they have any type of substance problems, they're not allowed to be in the program. They're heavily screened because it's specifically for young people ready and willing and very motivated to make that transition, you know, to receiving their high school accreditation and then to go on and receive job support services so they can be successful in the community.
Thank you.
And it's part-time.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. This will be our time to talk amongst ourselves.
Normally for an ICA, we usually look at 1 year sobriety, but there's no set date on that. With this one, without going into any details, it does look like she had extensive treatment. class ended a shorter amount of time frame. Still do have some concerns, but I don't think those concerns rise to the level of suspending it for another 5 months just to get through a year.
Thoughts on that before? I believe we need to sign for the additional violations if Mr. Zemanski wanted to move and then do a modified.
If I ask that maybe you do a vote to release first.
First, and then do those two motions. Okay.
So, because the ICA, and there was one before that, that was the 36 one?
The ICA, correct.
Is that still in effect for another 12, or?
Well, actually, technically for 24 months, but I think maybe what you want to do first, Mr. Szymanski, is make have a motion to release her and see if it's...
forward from that. Okay. So I'll make a motion to release from the ICA.
Second, Trotter.
All in favor?
Aye.
All right. Opposed? Motion carried.
And then the next step would be to fine for the violation, which
okay.
is the L violation.
So I'll fine for the ARS 32-3251-16L, engage in any conduct, practice, or condition that impairs the ability of the licensee to safely and competently practice the licensee's profession, and that's level.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
So then to your question, Mr. Szymanski, so the original consent agreement was for 36 months. The first 12 months, her license was going to be suspended while she was getting therapy and so forth. My suggestion to the board members would to consider modifying the consent agreement for 24 months because that's technically what she had left, possibly consider that clinical supervision stipulation as well as therapy and anything else that you feel that we need to to keep track of in compliance during that 24 months.
Okay. I would want to make some modification if we're not doing a new.
It's just the existing consent agreement is still there, so just the modification makes the most sense and the easiest because the other one didn't get released.
Okay. All right. So I think random drug testing twice a month would be appropriate. Clinical supervision once a week would be appropriate. Counseling with a LIFSAC, and I'd like to see that one time a week for 3 months, and I know I'm currently not seeing a LIFSAC, but I would, if things have changed since the original consent agreement, I'd like to see that based on what's happened since the original consent agreement. And that could go to twice a month for the 9 months, and then based on the recommendation of the therapist. I would like to see 12-step twice a week and a sponsor within 30 days. And is it possible to specify for the counseling that she shows up on time? It's a benefit consent agreement because... Okay, I would like to just specify that just based on the notes.
Yes,
I think that's important to be on time.
I agree.
So, and then put a state suspension if not followed.
And I actually didn't get any of it because I was multitasking over here.
Sorry.
But I did get the random drug testing twice a month. The clinical supervision.
Once a week.
Once a week.
And then on-time counseling with a LIFSAC for once a week for 3 months.
Okay, and the clinical supervision will stay the same focus as what it was in the consent agreement?
Well, I think we should add self-care, or never mind, that goes in the counseling part. Yeah, it can stay in the same.
Okay.
Well, I said for the counseling.
Okay.
So clinical supervision once a week for
24 months.
Yes.
Sorry.
And then I said counseling. I realize that she's seeing somebody now, but I would like a LIFSAC just because the person she was seeing before is mental health and those the mental health issues before and now has substance abuse. And I would just like that once a week for 3 months just to make sure we really, because we are releasing fairly
once
early.
A week for 3 months.
Right. And then it can go twice a month for 9 months, and then at the recommendation of the therapist, if the therapist feels to be released. And then 12-step for twice a week, and then a sponsor. I think a sponsor helps. I realize you have an accountability partner, but having a former relationship with that person, a sponsor might provide a little bit more accountability.
Yeah.
So.
Would it be okay if we just listed a recovery group rather than 12-step?
12-step or like program?
Okay. We typically don't specify. We usually use recovery. So that's
okay, fine. Recovery, yeah.
And then if not signed, should we remain on the ICA?
Oh, and then the state suspension if it's...
So no longer a state revocation?
Because, yeah, state suspension because of substance abuse and there's the possibility of appeal.
Would we also want to include the six CEUs of staying out of trouble or equivalent since she was unable to...
You didn't finish the second day of that training, right?
That's correct.
Okay, yeah, we'd finish those.
Okay, we'd be offering the licensee a modified consent agreement to include random drug testing twice monthly. She'd be required to get weekly supervision for the 24 months. The focus would remain the same. She'd also be required to get be involved in a recovery group twice a week with a sponsor for the entire 24 months. She also would be required to get therapy with a LISAC once a week for the first 3 months, twice a month the next 9 months, and after that, upon the recommendation of the therapist, she could ask for release. There would be a state suspension. She'd also be required to take 6 contact hours of staying out of trouble or the equivalent, and if not signed, she'd remain on the ICA. Would that be your motion?
That would be my motion. Thank you very much.
Before that's voted, Ms. Zavala, there's a technical. I know we're in discussion, so I didn't want to interrupt the discussion, but there is one issue that did come up based on those terms.
If Ms. Zavala is comfortable with it.
Madam Chair, I think it would be appropriate to have Mr. Carey address the board in regards to the requirement for the LISAC therapist as she's going through the Wellbeing Institute, which seems to be addressed some of that. Mr. Samantha, you would know more of that than I would. But if we could hear from Mr. Flynn Carey, that'd be okay.
Sure.
Thank you. And this is more for instruction from the board as opposed to trying to dictate any terms. But she's on as you may have seen, Board Member Szymanski, she's on a medication-aided type of recovery with Wellbeing Institute. And I would obviously defer to you and your colleague on if the Wellbeing Institute could either be a substitute for the LISAC or if there is a component where what I don't want is to necessarily put on her 4 visits with a healthcare professional a week. If the board believes that 2 is the number, how the Wellbeing Institute fits into that, because it is medication-aided, it does involve drug testing as part of her ability to have the medication-aided therapy, and so I just wanted to make sure that was on the board's radar in your motion and see if that alters how you would like to structure it.
Okay, so she's going to, I didn't want to talk about the medical, you're going to stay on the medication?
Yeah.
You don't have to answer this question. But is it injected or are you taking the oral?
Oral.
Okay. All right. As long as she's, I guess I would be okay with as long as she was still in that program and still taking the medication, that could suffice for the LISAC.
We have it in there. If that changes, then
if that changes, then we'll. I just wanted to make sure that they
instructed within 10 days or some period of time to tell the board.
And how frequently does she attend that program?
Twice a week.
What is the credential of the
in charge? The person who wrote the letter for her is a PA, and my understanding is that it's staffed with mental health and addiction specialists. I don't have the exact credentials of the individuals. Do you know?
He runs the group, a psychiatrist.
Yeah. Psychiatrist, okay.
Yes, psychiatrist. And I am drug tested weekly.
Without getting into the medical part, it is addressing the substance abuse, and I just didn't feel like the substance abuse was adequately addressed with the mental health counselor she was seeing before. So that's why I wanted to make sure that the substance abuse was being addressed. So that's why but I didn't want to have to go into the. I didn't want to ask you questions about your treatment. So I'm comfortable with that. Again, if she stops that program, then she would need the...
Okay. So just to be clear, so she would continue participating in the well-being program for a minimal of a year?
I don't know how long the program is.
It can go on indefinitely.
Okay. So if it's not a year, then she needs to complete a year with a LISAC, as long as she's receiving substance abuse treatment for a year.
For a year. Okay. A year.
Kramer, were you comfortable with this?
Yeah, I guess if she no longer attends the institute, then the LISAC will it's not a contingency that she stay in that institute for the year, correct?
Right. What I'll put in the consent agreement is that she will continue with the well-being institute for a minimum of 1 year. If that were to end within 10 days, she would have to notify the board, and at that time would have to see a LISAC. Once a week.
Yeah. This is your concerns.
Covers it.
All right. Then that is my motion. Thank you.
Motion. Do we have a second?
Bailey, second.
Roll call, please.
Kimberly Bailey.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
With hopeful optimism, aye.
Mary Coonrod.
Aye.
Cedric Davis.
Aye.
Patricia Dobratz.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Megan Kramer.
Aye.
Cassandra Parr?
Aye.
Mark Shin?
Aye.
Gerald Szymanski?
Aye.
Antoine Trotter?
Aye.
Motion passes. Best of luck to you.
Thank you for everything.
We appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you both. Let's take a break. It's 10:22. Let's come back at 10:30, please. All right. We're going to go back on the record. It is 10:31. And we'll go to agenda item number 7B, Victor Okori. Is the licensee present? Please come forward. And you would introduce yourself for the record, please.
Victor Okori.
All right, and same procedure. We're going to hear first from board staff.
Chair, members of the board, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the allegations. ARS 3232516L, engaging in any conduct, practice, or condition that impairs the ability of the licensee to safely and competently practice the licensee's profession. This recommendation is based on the following. From approximately 420 to 421, licensee provided clinical supervision to supervisee at agency to assist her in satisfying the supervision requirement of her consent agreement. As a LISAC, supervisee's scope of practice is limited to the practice of substance abuse counseling. Although she was statutory limited, supervisee provided behavioral health services to numerous clients that did not include any substance abuse or chemical dependency theories, techniques, or treatments. Although licensee acknowledged to board staff that he was aware of supervisee scope limitations as a LISAC, a board investigation of supervisee revealed that in 2021, 30 out of 35 of licensee's active clients of agency were being treated for general mental health issues not related to substance abuse or chemical dependency. Not only was licensee supervisee's clinical supervisor at the time, he also owned the agency. Licensee represented the following regarding supervisee practicing out of her scope. Licensee was not aware that supervisee was practicing out of her scope and acknowledges that he should have been aware. Licensee has been doing this part-time. This contributed to licensee's absence while supervisee was treating clients that were not within her scope. Licensee and supervisee never went into detail about specific cases. It did not cross his mind to question her caseload. Licensee assumed supervisee would never act outside of her scope. If he had known, licensee would have kept a closer eye on supervisee. Cases were assigned to supervisee if the receptionist felt it was within supervisee's scope of practice. Licensee signed a contract that she would only practice within her scope. It is concerning that despite taking on the responsibility of being supervisee's clinical supervisor, licensee did not monitor supervisee to adequately ensure that she was practicing within her scope. Given the fact that the clinical supervision notes indicate licensee asked supervisee for a full list of her client caseload and further indicates they had a general discussion of overall client progress from the caseload, licensee's representation that he did not know supervisee was out of scope, or never went into detail about specific cases appears to be less than candid. Additionally, it's concerning that it appears licensee allowed supervisee and a non-licensed agency receptionist handle the responsibility of ensuring that supervisee practiced within her scope. Furthermore, although licensee points to an independent contractor agreement signed by supervisee that she would not practice beyond her scope, the following facts are problematic. The agreement was not signed until the board began investigating the complaint against the supervisee. The agreement was signed over 1 year after licensee began supervising supervisee, and the agreement was signed the month after supervisee was released from her consent agreement. Licensee made the following statements about supervisee and his board investigation that are highly concerning. All this is because supervisee had some mental health cases that were not just strictly substance abuse cases. I am just flabbergasted at the extent of the investigation just because someone had a mental health case versus just having a substance abuse caseload. The board is doing a disservice by investigating licensee. Licensee does not want to be the clinical director at an agency because of situations like this. Licensee has had colleagues in the past who have provided supervision and have had similar experiences with the board. Licensee loves what he does and wishes the board would stop doing stuff like this. Investigations such as this are not helping the counseling profession. The law enforcement response to this whole thing is uncalled for. Licensee wishes that the board would just dismiss this matter. Licensee's statements regarding supervisee's conduct and board staff's investigation are concerning as they call into question whether licensee grasps the importance of complying with the board's rules and statutes that are designed to ensure the safety and welfare of the public. Specifically, it appears licensee is minimizing supervisee's failure to adhere to rules involving scope of practice as well as his responsibility and her supervisor to provide proper oversight. By not properly overseeing supervisee, licensee failed to ensure she was providing services that were congruent with her education, training, and statutory obligations. And that's all I have unless you have any questions for me.
Do board members have any questions? You have up to 5 minutes to address the board.
Good morning. As you know, as the clinical director on our agency, I take full responsibility for my supervisor's caseload. I have no excuses. I never minimize the degree of my responsibility in this complaint. It was probably the investigator's subjective interpretation of my responses during the questioning. I've been licensed for almost 15 years now, and with no complaints. So I do appreciate the value of complying with ethics, rules, regulations, and statutes, laws. So the report is a little skewed, but I do take full responsibility for not closely monitoring my supervisor's caseload. I must also note that we have put in place policies that would address the issue. And also, during this period of time, I was working part-time. I was distressed. My mom was ill in New York, so I would always travel to New York to take care of her. She has since passed away, but I was going back and forth to New York, and he showed us she's okay, and that's why she noted that I was working part-time. So I was in distress. I do take full responsibility for that.
Our time to talk amongst ourselves.
Yes, thank you so much, Madam Chair, members of the board. As I hear the response of the licensee this morning, I find that that sounds a little bit different from what I got from the record. And I appreciate his acknowledgement of his responsibility. Had he not presented, then I would have understood that he really didn't feel a need to give serious consideration to the laws and the rules and the statutes that govern the professional counselor license that he's held in this state since 2010. And it sounds like he does respect that the full spectrum of regulatory effort of the licensing board is of consequence. And I hear words that shift from what I read in the record as his willingness to blame the regulatory board when the professional has failed himself and others who are counting on him and other professionals to be the professionals that they represented themselves to be. And so after decades of service to this board, I acknowledge that I serve because I believe that the public deserves for every counselor and therapist to autograph their professional mental health work with excellence, and I see no reason why this licensee should receive a pass. I think it's important to be present in your practice and to adequately attend to that practice. So I'm available to hear arguments contrary to my representations before I move to fine for the violation of Arizona Revised Statute 32-3251-16L, engaging in any conduct, practice, or condition that impairs the ability of the licensee to safely and competently practice the licensee's profession.
Supervisors, you're not only obligated for your own adherence, but to do everything you can to have your supervisees trained to uphold their obligation to protect the public and to provide services. Our rules and statutes and
thank you. I move to fine for the violation.
Bailey, second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Questions for moving forward, Doc?
Dispose of the matter. I really believe that the licensee should be offered a consent agreement stipulating and ordering that the credential be placed on probation for a period of 24 months with the possibility of early release. He should complete a pre-approved 3-credit-hour graduate level course in behavioral health ethics within the upcoming 12 months. He should repeat the 12-hour clinical supervision course and submit a certificate of completion to the board. And the coursework that is taken should not be used for any upcoming license renewal. I believe that a stayed suspension would help to ensure that the stipulations of the consent agreement are met. And if the consent agreement is not accepted and signed, the board staff would identify additional remedies. But I'd like to hear a word from my colleagues if, on your review of the materials, what you think.
I think that's very good, Doc. I'm in agreement.
So typically when we're only ordering them to do education, it's only 12 months. You still want to do 24 months? You're basically giving them 24 months to complete the education.
12 months is fine.
So we would be offering the licensee a consent agreement for 12 months. You'd be required to take a 3-credit graduate level course in behavioral health ethics as well as 12 hours in clinical supervision. And as it will state in the template, they cannot be used towards his clinical supervision training or his renewal. If not signed, if not signed, invited to a formal interview, and if not accepted, remanded to a formal hearing. Would that be your motion?
That's my motion.
Is there a second?
Bailey, second.
Roll call, please.
Kimberly Bailey.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Mary Coonrod.
Aye.
Cedric Davis.
Aye.
Patricia Dobratz.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Megan Kramer.
Aye.
Cassandra Parr.
Aye.
Mark Shen.
Aye.
Gerald Szymanski.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
Thank you. This will conclude the matter. You will be receiving follow-up from the board that will outline everything from today and your next step.
Thank you.
All right, best of luck to you. Thank you. All right, we will go to 7C, Cynthia Wolcott. I don't believe the licensee was going to be here, but... All right. Can we hear a brief summary from board staff?
Madam Chair, members of the board, there was a supplement that was uploaded with just 4 points, basically just stating that the applicant wants to withdraw her application and that she would not be here today. That has been uploaded for your review. So what this looks like is being that this individual, Ms. Wolcott, is an applicant. Once the board notified her of the investigation, as well as the concerns that we had, she then requested that her application be withdrawn. And based on the law, she doesn't get to withdraw without the board's approval. So what the board needs to determine first before moving forward to the matter is whether or not you're going to allow Ms. Wolcott to withdraw her application. She was notified of the investigation, and so a decision would need to be made that if the conduct doesn't warrant unprofessional conduct, the board could consider allowing her to withdraw. But if it warrants unprofessional conduct, then you would want to deny that withdrawal.
Any questions from board members?
Based on the information that she was wanting to withdraw her application upon being noticed that there was an investigation, I would propose and move that we deny the ability to withdraw her application.
Second. Kramer. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. And then do we need a motion to open up the...
Okay. I move... Continuing what we're reading here today, I move that we open up a complaint.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
So, Madam Chair, members of the board, if we can now turn to the analysis. An applicant for licensure must meet the requirements of ARS 323275, which includes the following. A6, not have committed any act or engaged in any conduct that would constitute grounds for disciplinary action against a licensee pursuant to this chapter. Following review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 3232516L, engaging in any conduct, practice, or condition that impairs the ability of the applicant to safely and competently practice the profession. This recommendation is based on the following. On 2/16/21, applicant submitted her LCSW application with the board, indicating that she had a previous complaint against her professional license in Idaho. Within her LCSW application, applicant indicated that she completed a 2-year probationary period for having a relationship with a client that she was friends with for a long time. The Idaho Board's investigative records included the following. Applicant had a prior personal relationship with husband and client through a music ministry in a non-professional setting. From 2/10 to 2/11, applicant provided hospice services to client and husband at two different agencies. Applicant started a relationship with husband while providing hospice services to client and husband. Husband purchased a vehicle and a laptop for applicant between 2010 and 2011. Applicant acknowledged hugging and kissing husband. Applicant recommended husband enroll client in services at River City. When applicant's former husband was dying, applicant and husband relied on each other for support and companionship. In 3/11, applicant started working at River City Hospice, and in 5/11, client was admitted to the River City Hospice where applicant began providing hospice services to client and husband. Applicant spoke to River City's hospice's owner and disclosed her relationship with husband, and the owner stated that this would not be a conflict of interest. A 128-14 Idaho Board consent order indicated the following. Applicant provided hospice services to client and husband from 11/9 to 6/11. From 5/10 to 6/11, applicant engaged in a romantic relationship with husband. On 126-16, the Idaho Board released applicant from probation. Although applicant represents that she learned from the Idaho Board complaint and now has firm boundaries with clients, it is highly concerning that applicant married husband, who she acknowledges she was considered a client when providing hospice services. Not only did applicant marry husband, she married him while still on the Idaho consent order. In addition to marrying husband and after client's death,
It is highly concerning that applicant engaged in a romantic relationship with husband while providing hospice services to client and husband. And just as a notation for the board members, currently she's still licensed in Idaho. It's board staff's understanding that Idaho is not aware that she actually married the husband while on the consent agreement. In addition to that, she has a pending application with Washington, and we don't believe that they're aware that she married this individual either. So based on the board's decision today, we would be notifying them of these actions. And that's all I have, unless you have questions for me.
I guess I have an informational question, because I guess because this is an applicant and not a licensee, when we file a complaint, what does it entail? What does it do to that applicant? Because they're not a licensee, so is this going to be something on the website saying this applicant? Because they're not a licensee, so I'm interested in that.
So if the board members today decide to fine for the violation and then decide to take action, the options for action would be either to grant her a license with a CA or to deny it for unprofessional conduct. Based on the conduct, I would suspect that the board would be denying her for unprofessional conduct. She would then get a notification why she's been denied, and after the 35 days for her to appeal that decision, that letter of denial would go on the board's website for a public document, as well as it would be reported to HIPDB, which is a national databank, as well as we would be notifying Washington and Idaho.
Thank you.
I have just wondered this. We haven't seen this very many times. I think sometimes in the form of, like, friendships. But there is no way to cure this, essentially. You know, they're always going to be in a continuing violation unless she were to separate from her husband.
That would be correct. And just for a clarification point, when we received the application, we actually weren't notified that she married the client. It was actually discovered because our investigators are amazing, and we were able to put things together to find out. So she wasn't even transparent in that part either.
I don't think I could reiterate what's been, it's been presented today in the testimonies, you know, just testaments so far by board staff and the two questions asked by our board members. The more concerning piece is that the applicant is not even here today. And so there isn't even this added ability to feel that this is an important piece, and that's concerning. So, you know, without being redundant, I just think the facts support the violation, and so I'm going to move that we fine for the violation of unprofessional conduct 32-32-51-16 appropriate relationship.
Is there a second?
Sure. For a second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Madam Chair, can I ask for the board members to consider voting on allowing board staff to notify her current place of employment, which happens to be a hospice in the state of Arizona? You know, typically, when we get a formal order, we will be notifying the states involved, but she's not licensed by us, so I'm asking if it's something where we can notify her current place of employment, which, again, is a hospice, I believe, Hospice of the Valley in Arizona.
Please. Is there a motion?
So moved. Bailey.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. And I don't believe the denial is part of your motion.
No, now it is, though.
Okay.
I move that we deny the applicant an application or a license based on endorsement based on the violation of unprofessional conduct.
Second. Yes, please. Roll call, please.
Kimberly Bailey.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Mary Coonrod.
Aye.
Cedric Davis.
Aye.
Patricia Dobratz.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Megan Kramer.
Aye.
Cassandra Parr.
Aye.
Mark Shin.
Aye.
Gerald Szymanski.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
I apologize, Dr. Bailey. I think I interrupted your process there.
And that concludes our disciplinary matters.
We need to make a motion to refer this to other states or
no? No, we can do that, yes.
Okay.
I really wanted to vote because it's not typical for us to notify the agency, but in this case, being that it was a hospice, it seems necessary for them to be aware.
Do we want to go to agenda item number 8, our report from our Assistant Attorney General?
Yes, thank you. Good morning, members of the board. Mona Baskin, Assistant Attorney General. I am here for your yearly review of the legislative changes. The memo is quite long. It contains over 20 bills. I am not going to speak on all 20 of them this morning. We've already had quite a busy morning. I do want to point out several of the ones that I believe are key. And the first one is actually the first one on page 1. It involves Senate Bill 1063. And this relates to the Administrative Procedures Act, Administrative Decision Scope of Review. And this would be in cases in the event that a licensee asked for a filed appeal from the board's administrative decision, whether it would be an OAA decision that was affirmed by the board or the board following a formal hearing. And what this statute does, it requires the Superior Court to decide questions of fact without deference to what this board ultimately does. And this amendment also mirrors the 2018 amendment, which took away the Chevron standard. And what the Chevron standard was that on appeal, the reviewing court, the Superior Court on a judicial review action, would defer to the board on decisions regarding questions of law. So now, as it currently stands, there is no deference to the administrative decision regarding the facts and the law. It also permits a licensee on appeal to request a trial de novo in the Superior Court. And at this point, we really don't know what that means. I think this is going to take some further testing to see how that is all going to play out. Wanted to next turn and to the agency's website posting of board actions, and that is Senate Bill 1357, and that amends actually two of the statute, and it limits the time that a final agency disciplinary and non-disciplinary orders and other actions can be posted on the website, and it limits it to not more than 5 years. And by removing this information from the website, it doesn't affect the fact that these are actually public records that can be requested about from the licensees. And the Senate bill leaves unchanged the requirement that the recordings of meetings and the board actions, with the exception of board letters of concern and advisory letters, be posted on the website for at least 3 years. And from what my understanding is, that the board is going forward and implementing this. This is quite a lot of work to do as far as the website. I did want to point out that there is a trend within the country to have boards, have the criminal courts adopt a statute that provides them to issue a certificate of second chance. This has been with a few of the states across the country, and Arizona did that this year in House Bill 2067, and that really modified a criminal statute, which is ARS 13905, regarding criminal convictions set aside and applicability. It allows the court to issue a certificate of second chance to someone to have a conviction set aside. And what this does is, if a person receives the certificate of second chance, they're released from, I want to read this directly from the memo, barriers and disabilities in obtaining an occupational license issued under 32 that resulted from the conviction if the person is otherwise qualified. The new language clarifies that this certificate of second chance should not be construed as a recommendation for licensure. So this would mean that the conviction would be set aside, and it should not be seen as something that would be a barrier for an individual to apply. There are some stipulations as far as exclusion. It's available to applicants that are convicted of both felonies and misdemeanors. To individuals who are convicted of class 4, 5, or 6 felonies, if at least 2 years have lapsed from the time that the conditions of probation or sentence were fulfilled. So what it does is once the probationary term or the sentence has been fulfilled, so whether it be a 2 year, whether it's, I mean, and these are class 4 felonies, class 5 felonies, and those are individuals that could be potentially incarcerated. So it would be a 2 year tail after that they could go ahead and apply for this certificate. And those are convicted of a class 2 or 3 felony, there has to be a longer time, 5 years lapse from the time the individual has fulfill the conditions of probation or sentence, and it is not specific regarding, you know, types of offenses. And, of course, this is something that the individual, that the convicted individual would have to apply for from the court, and they would have to obtain a court order.
Askin?
Yes.
If they have the certificate and the setting aside, that doesn't relieve the obligation to report it on the application, though, right?
We're going to have that. That's a very good question, and we'll have to. But I believe the way the language on the board's applications are very, very broad, and it would be, have you ever been convicted, and also has anything been set aside? Am I correct, Ms. Zavala? So they would have to disclose. The board, you know, may wish to consider amending it and putting in, this includes a certificate of second chance obtained from the Superior Court, just to be very clear so that individuals filling out the application would actually know what to disclose. But, yes, that would be something that would be disclosed. And, again, that is something that has been a trend across the country. I do want to talk about undesignated offenses and not to focus all on criminal law, but these are some significant changes that I think the board has to be aware. And this is House Bill 2162, and it affects, again, a criminal statute, and that's 13604. And these are designated offenses, misdemeanors. Oftentimes when individuals are convicted, they will be receiving a Class 6 undesignated offense. Currently, the way the law is, those Class 6 felonies that are undesignated, that means they're not designated a felony or a misdemeanor, are designated felonies. And it's thought that that's an impetus for the individual to comply with their probation and be successful. This law, which becomes effective on July 1st of 2022, amends that requirement that all Class 6 undesignated felonies that do not involve a dangerous offense be treated as a misdemeanor instead of felonies, with certain exceptions not applying to issuance or maintaining a license. So, it allows the court to make that ultimate decision about whether or not it is a misdemeanor or a felony after the completion of the conditions of probation and the ultimate discharge. And then turning to probably the most impactful legislation for the board is the telehealth legislation, and I know Ms. Zavala already presented this to the board, and that would be HB 2454. And it significantly changed with the definition of telehealth, which is broader and more expansive. It addressed actually two of the definitions within the board's definitional section, one relating to direct client contact, and what it did, it included just a phrase at the end, but it is pretty significant, that the definition includes now the use of telehealth pursuant to the new definition of telehealth. It also changed your definition of telehealth to reflect the new definition of telehealth within the statute. And what that that is 363601, and what that provides is that telehealth is able to be performed, and this is in even in individuals with obtaining those direct client contact hours through the, and I'm going to be reading from this because I want to be really specific, interactive use of audio, video, or other electronic media, including asynchronous stored and forward technologies and remote patient monitoring technologies for the practice of healthcare assessment, diagnosis, consultation, or treatment, and the transfer of medical data. Now, it does include an exception for audio-only telephone encounters. So that would be only as determined by the mental health provider, and the mental health provider would have to determine that an audiovisual mental health encounter is not reasonably available, and that would be either through the patient's actual functional status, the patient's lack of technology, or the telecommunications infrastructure limitations. So that would have to be something that would be determined by the healthcare provider to be able to have the audio only. So I think the preference is for a visual and audio also. And then finally, I wanted to touch on I know when Ms. Zavala was addressing tracking all the bills and keeping up on all the legislation that occurs, there was a reference to the fact that the board lost their ability to employ a lobbyist. And I went back and I pulled my my advice memo on that. And just to let the board know that that did occur in 2017, and Mr. Charles was the one that brought that up during that discussion. There is a another statute that was passed pursuant to Senate Bill 1272. It's for health board executive directors, so it would not apply to this board, but just also to let you know that if the executive directors of a non-health board are unable to present from lobbying for or against a legislation proposed in their official capacity until the board takes a formal position on it. So that that kind of dovetails on the discussions that this board had regarding the loss of the lobbyist and just some additional legislation on that. So that concludes my presentation for this morning. Thank you.
Any questions? Yeah, just to follow up on that last one.
Mm-hmm.
That still doesn't affect us at all, right?
No. I just thought that because Mr. Charles brought it up, that we had that discussion about that it was a few years old. I went back and I did pull my advice memo. It would have been Mr. Harris that provided the board of advice back in 2017. But the genesis of that legislation was from an executive order. So I thought this was a good opportunity to let the board know about that. And then also to follow up about that is for non-health boards, but just to let you know of, and I did include another statute in there, some statutory changes that don't have to do with the health board. But I think it's important that the board be aware of all these legislative changes to see how it impacts the administrative and regulatory procedures within the state of Arizona, and that's very valuable information for you all. So thank you.
We haven't seen any applications submitted with a certificate of second chance yet, have we?
No. No, and that would have been something that that they would have had. Well, I mean, they very well could have because it's already November, because that these laws became effective at the end of September the 29th. But, you know, somebody could have obtained one of a certificate of second chance in the interim.
So we should get that applications updated.
Correct.
Thank you, Ms. Baskin. Let's all go in order, or do you have a preference?
I think if we could go in order until you get to mine.
Yep. Let's go to agenda item number 10, our application. And do you want to speak to that, Ms. Zavala?
our last board meeting, we've licensed 91.
Shorter period between a week early. Go to our denials.
The Substance Abuse Academic Review Committee has reviewed the applications of the following individuals and recommends the denial for licensure. One application based on failure to pass the required exam. Three applications based on a failure to take the required examination. For a total of four denials, and that's my motion.
Okay.
Bailey, second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Social work.
The Social Work Academic Review Committee has reviewed the applications of 10 individuals and recommends their denial for licensure. Seven applications recommended for denial based on a failure to pass the required examination. Two applications recommended for denial based on a failure to take the required examination. And one application recommended for denial based on a failure to meet minimum requirements. And I move it.
There a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
The Marriage and Family Therapy Academic Review Committee has reviewed the applications of the following individual and recommends their denial for licensure. One application based on a failure to pass the required examination and one application based on a failure to meet the minimum requirements. I move that we have a total of two denials.
Chen, second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
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 The County Academic Review Committee has reviewed the applications of the following individuals and recommends their denial for licensure. Six applications based on a failure to pass the required examination, one application based on a failure to take the required examination, and one application based on a failure to meet minimum requirements. Total denials is eight.
Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. That will take us to our report from Treasurer, agenda item number 12.
The cash flow report for the month of October is before you, and I think we weren't able to do the one for September.
Actually, this one's for September. We have not received October's yet.
October. There we go. Okay, this is for September. And we've reviewed it, and I move it.
Is there a second? All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. And we'll table the October financial report. And Ms. Bala, do we want to go to
agenda item 14A?
So this is for our request for extension of inactive status. 14A is Rita Rogers.
So Madam Chair, members of the board, as you know, the second inactive status has to come before the board. One of three reasons that they would be approved. One would be beyond their control, two would be military, and three would be medical. Ms. Rogers has submitted the inactive request stating that she serves on the Tucson City Council and it's too much work. That's all I have, unless you have questions for me.
Not appear to meet. Is there a motion?
Move to deny.
Bailey, second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
And 14B? I'm sure members of the board. Our licensee, Israel, submitted an inactive, a secondary inactive request, and the reason listed is that they live in Texas due to COVID. And that's all I have, unless you have questions.
Move to deny, Davis.
Second. Bailey, second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Yes. All right. I'm going to take these a little bit out of order. I want to start with E, which is a staff update, and I'm passing around a couple of cards. I'll start with Megan, just so they're not on the public record. But we had two of our investigators due to better opportunities outside of the state. So it was really rough news for us because we have such a great team, and it was hard to accept, but unfortunately we just couldn't compete. So I'm super excited for both of them. We'll probably be staying in touch with both of them, but I thought it'd be good for you to see the cards that they gave to me just to show the teamwork that we have here at the board and significant loss. With that said, the last day, I think it was last Friday, we've conducted a number of interviews. We have hired an investigator from DES APS department. Adult Protective Services, and then we also promoted Allie, who's our compliance officer, to the investigator position, and then we've hired for Allie's position. Update on that.
Maybe not better positions, but advancing their career. Next.
Yes.
Well, it would be interesting to know where those states are. I'm retired. I'm just kidding.
They will be missed, though. They've been
yeah.
A great team.
Very much so. And I think now we'll go ahead and go back to A. A is the discussion regarding the all-licensee letter emailed on September 24, 2021. For those of you that are licensees, I'm hoping that you actually opened up your email and read it. For our four public members, I can appreciate the fact that this was uploaded to the member portal. We don't send too many letters out from the board because when we do, we get inundated personally, hundreds of emails because it's not clear or they have questions. So we really try to pick and choose when we send this out and try to make it as clear as possible. And it's typically when there's rule changes. So I'm going to go through these pretty quickly. Let me know if you have any questions or concerns. One was in regards to Senate Bill 1089, and that is no longer verifying indirect hours. Want to be clear for the record, indirect hours are happening. We're just not having them be verified. Then in regards to House Bill 2454, the verbal informed consent, this is really interesting to me. Again, this was, I think, a conversation that was had that probably wasn't discussed with our profession. So if you are providing telehealth services, you can take a verbal consent. However, it's kind of a moot point for us because if you provide more than one service, you're going to eventually have a treatment plan that does have to be signed. So as I present to people and have conversations, if you know better, do better, that informed consent is just as much your client's protection as it is your licensee's protection. So really, really important. I also like to say out loud that, you know, after this long of doing telehealth, I hope that we've figured out how to get signed documents when necessary. The next is what... I'm sorry.
Right, just to note, protection for several reasons for the licensee.
Very true.
Not just within protection.
And then Ms. Baskin already touched on this, and I think we talked about it before, the direct client contact. This is specific for associate-level licensees. Again, I think it's super concerning, and I hope that if we know better that we do better. We don't want an associate level getting an independent level license where they've only had phone conversations for 1,600 hours with clients. I think that would not be protecting the public, and I think it would be a disservice. I have to say that for the record. With that said, it is allowed at this time. We also included in here the substance abuse counseling scope based on conversations that we've had over the last year. I think Dr. Bailey was one that brought up, like, how can we educate? We just keep constantly trying to educate. I still firmly believe that when individuals go out of their scope as a LASAC, they know better. They're just doing it, and they're getting away with it. Because we've educated them enough to where I believe that they know that they have a limited scope. So this was just another way for us to remind them that they have a scope. It's also on their renewal every year. It's also on their license when we submit it out. Face-to-face clinical supervision, we included that. You all made a decision that we were going to reinterpret that face-to-face. So every 6 months, the 2 hours of face-to-face supervision is no longer required. Again, if your supervisor is down the street, please make that happen. But if you're across the country or even across the state, this could be something that that would allow for 100 of your hours to be over the video conference. So, and that will be something that we will be changing in upcoming rules. Does anybody have any questions on that letter?
I have one question.
Yes.
Do we know the percentage of licensees that opened the email?
Did we check that out? We don't have to do it now. Sometimes we look. I mean, If you can look now, we can open back to it.
That actually opened the, and yeah, I'm just curious. Usually it's like 80-something percent, right?
It's actually pretty neat because you could actually literally sit and watch Constant Contact and just watch them be opened. So I do tell people if you get an email from the board, we're not selling you anything. We're not marketing anything. We haven't lately, but when we first started doing it, we were getting people saying, please unsubscribe me. So
the number of opens correlate with the number of phone
calls. We'll come back to that. We'll come back to that.
You've been getting some feedback from the letter?
You know, a lot. I know our information bot, but I would say personally I probably got 100 questions. It was never clear enough. We spent a lot of time on that letter, and we kind of laugh because it seems like such a simple letter, but the reality is we have a lot to say, and we want to use as few words as possible, but we also want to make sure it's supported by statute. But we get a lot of feedback. But it's our way of, you know, doing our best at sharing with them what's happening, as well as, you know, unfortunately 2 years from now when they say, I didn't know, we can remind them this was out. You know, to this day we have people that, you know, will say in their out loud voices or in writing, I never received my 90-day renewal notice. That's why I didn't submit it. And we're able to go in and go, well, we show that you opened it on this day. Like, you know, so 71%.
Yeah.
So.
Go on record with just a comment.
Absolutely.
In response to Ms. Zavala, just with the indirect hours not being tracked, I just wanted to go on record to all supervisors that this does not mean that we relieve our duty of making sure that the other 1,600 hours are adequately met. It's just not being tracked. And just because it isn't being tracked, we need to make sure that the due diligence for all that other indirect work is being done, and that does fall on us. So I just wanted to remind us all to be really, really clear about that's still a requirement.
And to that point, Dr. Bailey, we did add a sentence onto the attestation that basically says something to that effect, that as the supervisor, you are responsible in making sure that they are aware of the board's rules, statutes, documentation, et cetera, for that reason.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Relates to clients.
So next, if we can talk about update regarding Ms. Zavala's participation in the Council of State Governments for Social Work Compacts. So I actually went to D.C., I guess it was like the first week of October, it was like a few months ago. But I got really excited when I was there just learning about the compact for social work. I don't have all of the answers just yet, but I know that there are 4 professions in the state of Arizona that are currently participating in the compact. The nursing board has been part of their own compact for years, but as of late, the psych board, the PT board, and goodness, one other board. This is happening. It's happening whether our licensees or our board agrees with it or not. It's happening. It was happening before COVID, and now with COVID, it's happening even more. So something that I learned while I was there that I like to share is that one of the first compacts was a driver's license. If you think about it, we all got our Arizona State driver's license, but that license allows us to drive in other states. So if you get a DUI in another state, or you get in an accident in another state, or you speed in another state, that state can take action on you. So if you use that same analogy, that's kind of what a compact will look like to a degree. Not the best analogy, but there's a lot of things. The State Department of Justice is the one that has the significant amounts of grants that they are providing for the Council of State Governments, who are then reaching out to various state leaders and having them be part of this. In order to be part of the compact for a profession, there has to be a minimum of 10 states. Right now there's 17, there's a current counseling compact, and there's 17 states that are talking about it. So this is happening, and so I still feel very honored to be invited to that table to be a part of it, because I think that Arizona, I like to think, is better than other states in so many ways. One, I just think we have a variety of people in a variety of, whether it be the metropolitan Phoenix area to the rural areas. We're very different than some of the other smaller states throughout the country. And so, you know, with that said, just to kind of piggyback on this, Senator Bartow just recently, in a phone conversation that I had with her, and some people from the Arizona Counseling Association have agreed to sponsor a bill. Now, all that means, and I wasn't lobbying, I was just educating and having conversations. But what that means is the associations are going to be the ones that really push this. At some point, it will come to the board. It will be the board's decision. But as always, our board makes decisions based on what the profession wants. So I'm part of that social work. It's going to come up in another couple of years. I think it's a really good thing for our state to be put to the table. If one of the first 10 states will, you know, likely somebody would be invited to be part of that team in drafting rules and such. So,
and I mean, I think it should be noted that we're thankful for your participation. And again, I think this goes to just your involvement out in the community and with other boards and going to these conferences and being in the know. And I know that from the NBCC conference that I was recently at, just that knowledge brings so much to what we can do here in Arizona. And so we appreciate that. I can't stress enough, we know if we're not involved that we lose that voice and influence. And so the associations are going to be huge. Thank you, Ms. Zavala.
Next, I just briefly asked discussion regarding HB 2454 in the registry. I was hoping today I would have more information, but I just don't. Basically, just real brief overview. Part of that bill was so that basically I think there's 17 professions that have to open and design a registry back in May because it was an emergency order, so people can register from, thank you, for other states to provide services here in Arizona. We're working on a database that's actually up right now, but we're not considering it live because I don't want to say my staff, I will say myself, I'm not ready for it to go live yet. Haven't put all of our ducks in a row yet, but by next month we will have that information to share with you all. It doesn't affect our licensees here. It really just affects people from out of state being able to practice here.
Can I ask a question? I don't know if you know the answer. I didn't think about it till today. With the registry in place, if we deny somebody an application in Arizona, but they are licensed somewhere else, could they apply for the registry?
It's a really good question. I think the answer to that is yes, but I will make note of that and have that answer for you next month. So next we'll go to H, discussion regarding database, and I'm going to try really hard not to be too excited about it. But just for a show of hands, who was around back when we were trying to get on the state e-licensing system and there was that $450,000 issue? And okay, so it was really scary. I'm not going to go back to that, but what I will tell you is that it was a really tough and rough experience for myself. And the fact that we were able to get that money back and then not have to be part of that state e-licensing system was, in my opinion, a success. And unfortunately, over the last couple of years, that e-licensing system has continued to not meet the needs of other boards. And there's been lots of complaints and concerns sent to the governor's office. And, you know, I've been kind of listening and trying to get involved in different things, but yet making sure that somebody else did it first, because the last time I did it first, it didn't go over really well for me. And so I did watch another one of our executive directors go through the process with the governor's office, and it was hard, and it was she'd probably refer to it as torturous, but just recently got approved to join a database system that appears that's going to work a lot better. And with that said, because of all the constant complaining and reaching out, it looks like hopefully by next Wednesday is the plan, that I'm going to sign a contract that is going to allow us to engage into a relationship with Sentia, who is going to design a new database system with us. This will take about 4 or 5 months of a lot of our staff time and effort to put into it. But when it's all done, none of us will have to work anymore because we're just going to push buttons and it's going to do it for us. No. But when it's all done, what it's going to look like is the 20th century. Let me go back.
Yeah.
21st century. And our licensees are going to be able to engage with that portal, so you'll have like your own license number and you'll be able to push it in and the portal will come up and you'll be able to interact with it, whether it's for, you know, renewals, CEUs, all sorts of things, payments. So it'll look good on the outside for individuals, licensees, applicants, and people, the public, but just as excitingly and probably more excitingly for our board staff, we will no longer have 30 spreadsheets. We're just going to have one system that does it all. Because what we do now, our database is a dinosaur, and so we have lots of various spreadsheets here or there, and sometimes it takes us longer to get certain things done because we have to do all that. So we're pretty excited about that. Hopefully in December I'll be able to come back and tell you this is happening. And we're doing this all within our regular annual budget. So pretty excited. Let's see. And next, if we can go to, this is actually a vote, and this is a review, consideration, and possible action regarding R46214. This has been uploaded. I apologize. Just for the record, I did upload the compact information for your all review, if anybody was interested in reviewing that. So R46214 was uploaded as well. So this is something that's really never come up before, and I will just tell you that, you know, I had made a decision years ago that we've been kind of doing, but all of a sudden lately people are questioning this. So I felt it would be important to bring it to the board for the board to hear what's occurring and for there to be a consideration of a report or a vote. So R46214 is the educational requirements for clinical supervisors. So when you have never provided clinical supervision before, you are required to take 12 hours. Super easy for most people in the state of Arizona, but what we're having is people that are coming from out of state, moving in, wanting to provide clinical supervision. They submit their educational requirements from 6 years ago. So in other words, they submit those 12 hours from clinical supervision that they've taken five, six. I think one was from 2010. And I've come back and said, well, no. I mean, you're required to do it every 3 years. So we've just kind of, you know, I don't want to say randomly, but we kind of configured at least thought if you have 12 hours in the last 3 years, that meets. Otherwise, it doesn't. It's not written in that the way it is here. So I'm asking the board members to consider if they believe that that is correct information. I mean, for us to approve somebody to provide clinical supervision that they haven't taken courses since 2010 is not, it's not what we want to do, I'm sure. So if the board members agree, and if you don't, I'd like to hear it, but if you do agree, I'd like to see a vote that the 12 hours has to be within the last 3 years.
Davis moves it.
Second. Hennigan second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried.
Next is review, consideration, and possible action regarding expired licenses and reapplication. So this is another interesting thing that I just don't think that it happened like in my first 10 years. And now all of a sudden this past year we're getting a lot of it, and I don't know why. But what this means is I'll use Dr. Hennigan for an example. She's licensed by our board. For whatever reason, she allows her license to expire. Sometimes they allow it and then they come back. Sometimes they just forget. And a year later, Dr. Hennigan wakes up and goes, oh, my gosh, my license expired. A, I've been practicing, so that's another issue. But B, what do I have to do? And when they call board staff, you know, we let them know you have to reapply. Well, problematically is if Dr. Hennigan would have waited 2 years, we no longer have a copy of her license file. So now Dr. Hennigan, because by retention law, we after somebody's license lapses, we discard their license. And so 2 years later comes, Dr. Hennigan applies for licensure, and she has to resubmit everything, which right there is always problematic and always upsetting to them. But then secondly, maybe Dr. Hennigan only has a 48-hour credit degree. Counseling now requires 60. Maybe her clinical supervisors have passed or she doesn't know how to find them. In order for her to be licensed as an LPC, she has to have that supervised work experience. So what I would like the board members to consider is, because I don't want this to be a hardship for licensees that inadvertently allow their licenses to pass or expire, or they decide they're going to retire and come back a few years later because it's not working out in life coaching or something like that, I want us to be able to consider that maybe we require them to meet the current rules for the associate level, but that just as a matter of board record to include that we have their information for supervised work experience. That's the biggest thing that we're having, is that people can't find their supervisors or people to verify their work. So now Dr. Hennigan's been licensed for, you know, 20 years as an LPC, and we're like, well, here's your LAC. But yet we know she met those requirements, but we don't have them and she can't produce them. With that said, I think it is imperative, unfortunately, if they allow their license to expire, I think it is imperative that they have to meet the educational requirements that are currently in place.
I have a question.
Why are we, do we purge records after 2 years?
Yes.
Is that required by law?
Yes.
Okay.
After they're expired.
I would just like to ask Dr. Hannigan how you could put yourself in that position.
And is do we know, would it be a hardship for some of these people if their licenses are old enough to meet the associate level?
It would be in some cases. Most cases, no, but we've had a couple that it would. But unfortunately, I just don't think that the board is in a position to just say, well, gosh, sorry, you haven't been licensed for 3 years. You can just come back in. The law says they have to reapply and meet current requirements. So that's why my thought is they have to meet the requirements of that associate level. But because we know at some point we did have that supervised work experience and we did have that clinical supervision, that we could just, Ms. Baskin, what words did you use?
They were such. Take judicial notice of the board.
There you go. We couldn't supervise work experience and clinical supervision.
We couldn't do that for their higher level life.
We couldn't do that. For the associate level, well, they may not meet current requirements.
Right.
So essentially, it's noted that they have the work experience verified. And again, to be clear, the law says if you allow your license to expire, you have to reapply and meet today's rules.
Yeah.
So if we wanted to be completely by the book and by the law, that would mean they'd have to meet the associate level requirements for which are their credentials, as well as supply their clinical supervision and their supervised work experience. And that's the one that we're having the biggest difficulty with. The majority appear to meet at the associate level, but I'm going to tell you that may not be the same for all.
Mm-hmm.
It's that supervised work experience and clinical supervision that seems to be the biggest hardship for individuals.
Got it.
I have a question about the education. So if they have a 48-hour degree, can they take the other 12 hours outside that? Like if somebody just takes 12 more hours to get to 60, it doesn't have to be within that?
That is correct.
Okay.
Thanks to Senate Bill 1374.
Okay. But then it used to be that way. I was just making sure that
used to be.
It was fixable.
Moral of the story, don't let it expire, but if you
Absolutely.
Do.
we've had about 10 this year.
I bet it's going to happen a lot because of COVID. Maybe some people are going to.
I don't know.
I so move.
Bailey, second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Ms. Cavallo, for bringing that to the floor.
Thank you. So on the agenda is 13G, discussion regarding court-appointed cases. I don't recall who asked for this to be on the agenda. So I think it would be a good opportunity for me to just kind of give an overview and then maybe my administrative thoughts as in regards to this. I've been with the board since 2010. I know prior than me starting here with the board in 2010, this is the way the board would handle these types of cases, the court-appointed cases, based on an order by the court. They would dismiss the case based on that. With that said, there's a variety of reasons why, and I think we all know it's a lot of it's the chilling effect that it would have on individuals taking the court-appointed cases. You know, most of the time, I would suspect all of the time when you are have the courts involved in a contentious case, it's probably because somebody doesn't like the other person. And so at the end of the day, when you're getting therapy for your kiddo or for yourself, at the end of the day, somebody is not going to be happy. And that's just really the stance that the board took for a long time. I will tell you that I started in 2010. That's the way we handled the cases. In 2012, we were audited by the Auditor General's Office, and they said, why are you even opening up these cases? You shouldn't be opening up these cases. And I suspect a couple of you, Ms. Coonrod, probably Mr. Davis, and maybe Mr. Szymanski might remember this. So then we thought, well, gosh, if we don't have to open up these cases, then we're not going to open these cases. So we put together, designed a little list of, it was always our understanding that we had to open up every case that came before us. And we were told at that time you didn't. So we put together a list of cases that we wouldn't open up. One of them was a supervisee and a complaining against their supervisor, not wanting to sign off on hours. One of them is not releasing records within 30 days. We give them a little bit more time. One was inmates in prison because they have a court a judicial process that they go through for their own complaints. One was court-appointed cases, and then, of course, there were some others. So that was in 2012. We had it up on our website. It was really a good thing for a lot of people. And then about 2014, unfortunately, something had transpired in another board where they weren't even looking at complaints, and something was overlooked. And based on that, we got word, not from the Auditor General's, but from another I would suspect the governor's office said, no, you do have to open up these complaints. So then we started opening them again and went back to the same way that we've been processing them until today, apparently. And so I just, I just want to go on the record that administratively I have a very difficult time being the executive director and going against a court order. I think that we've been doing this for years now with many of you on the same board. And if this is something that you're wanting our board to do different, it might be best for somebody else to do it, because I don't know what that looks like. And so that's all I have.
I think one of the questions that I had is the administrative process when the complaint comes, what information is given to the complainants in terms of that, the jurisdiction and the process and how that plays out.
So our investigators are very well of this process, and they speak not just once, probably not just twice, probably three or four times with the complainant in sharing this process and the way the board views these types of cases. Sometimes it is pleasant conversations and other times not so pleasant, but I will go on record to say that when that complainant comes to the board, they are very well aware of the board's position on these types of cases. They're very well aware that they can go back to the courts. And by the way, we've done that before, you know, for whatever that's worth. I also want to share, if we ever got something that was highly egregious, obviously we'd be going to the courts ourselves. So, answer?
Yeah, so they're made aware that they can, that the judge could give them clearance to bring it back to them.
That is correct.
And does it seem clear that the judges understand that we don't have jurisdiction of these cases? Or do we not know that because we never see?
I don't have the answer to that. I know that I tasked myself with this project probably about 3 or 4 years ago based on a case. I shouldn't talk about a case, sorry. Just based on a situation that had arisen, trying to get clarity and direction from the courts. And it was pretty much like calling the Department of Health Services. I didn't get any response.
Because one thing that I think could be helpful is, I know when you get a family law assignment, you probably get trained. Like, it'd be nice to know, and maybe they are trained on this, that they just learn at some point, you know, that we're not going to take these cases.
And I think that's a great idea. The problem is I don't know how to get there. I don't have a contact person. I don't know how to educate them. I think that, the way I see it, I think we're lucky that we get as few as we get, because can you imagine how many of these hundreds of cases are out there? I don't know this, but I would imagine thousands.
For the record, I know somebody here that represents the Superior Court if there's communication that needs to be had.
We could attempt.
I think that would be good.
That internal dilemma of knowing our obligations to protect the public, the information that's been presented, the appearance that it's a choice that we're making versus the obligation and responsibility that we have.
Ms. Kramer, may I comment on your question? I have seen specific orders from the court that do address it and that specifically address the issue regarding complaints to the board. So it's usually codified within these orders, and the orders are generally very specific on that, and they're very specific on the immunity. So I believe that's part of the that is the main reason for the board's decision, and that has been the board's position since over almost 10 years, but it is specifically addressed by the judge and signed and provided to the parties.
So everyone's basically on the same page, and it's, they just come here anyway.
But again, I think we need to recognize the amount of people that come here. It's a very few number. And again, I'm not suggesting that, you know, that their concerns are not warranted. I just have concerns with us doing something different than what we've always done. And it's not on here as a vote, but I need direction to be able to tell my staff. I've just not processed these complaints anymore. I don't know what we're doing, because I think what we did today is concerning to me as the administrator.
I have concerns people using our credentials for, you know, for some kind of authority and some kind of competence, and we have no authority to review it, and yet we still have a vote. If I would be more comfortable if we just didn't open them, like we used to not open them, because we're not voting on it. We're just saying we don't have jurisdiction, we don't open it. And I'm not sure that the courts understand the limitations of our licensees, and they just see a license and they assume that the licensee is competent to do what they're doing. And that's uncomfortable for me to keep just sending them back and saying we're not going to look at it. So if we completely didn't open, like we used to not open them, that made sense, because we just didn't open it. If we're voting on it, it's becoming more uncomfortable as the cases are more.
The flip side is, there's a more uncomfortable and not have that eyes on it for that time period when.
But if we're not going to do anything with it, jurisdiction, then why even look at it?
I'm not sure that I agree, because, you know, we were implying that we wouldn't do anything. If there was egregious conduct, we would go to the courts ourselves. You know, what we heard today was a one-sided story.
We didn't have any information
in front of us to suggest that there was egregious behavior from our licensee. And I think if there were, we would go to the courts and say, we have concerns. So it's not that we just turn our head and not investigate, you know. So
I get my concern about today was that it's a LASAC operating basically independently, and it was.
I don't think we want to talk about this.
Okay. My concern would that there be that LASACs are allowed to do this, and I'm not sure the court understands the limitations of that.
And rather than not have it come before us, I think it's real important that it come before us, and it's all right in my universe to be uncomfortable. I've been uncomfortable lots and lots of times over the past couple decades, because that's what I agreed to do. I agreed to be here. So I'd rather hear it. And I hear us saying, we don't have the jurisdiction. You may need to go back to the court and so forth. So the individual does get a measure of direction here. They may not get satisfaction, because we don't have that for them. But if they get direction, and if they eventually get satisfaction, then I still feel as though it's worth whatever discomfort we may have.
I agree. And I think it seems clear that when they leave, they understand. It has recently.
Yeah, I don't like it. But I like that we do provide the help that we can provide.
I hate to put you on the spot, but you requested this be on the agenda. Is there anything specific that you want to
know? No, I think we have discussed this thoroughly, and I'm sure that this probably will be a discussion in the future going forward as future cases arise. So, I think we had a good discussion about it. Thank you for elaborating on the historical significance on how we used to handle these cases and how we handle them now and whatnot. So it's good to know that as a public member and not understanding the whole process. So hopefully, clients going forward, understand this and know how to act appropriately if they haven't been told so, or if they don't properly understand.
So it hasn't been agendized as an
action item, but...
Right. I will like to ask, I think that the board should consider it being agendized as an action item next month to give direction to board staff on how they want to handle these cases. I don't think that the dialogue on each of these cases is going to be healthy for myself or for the people that are here each and every time. I think the board needs to make a decision on how you want to act on these cases.
I think we should put it on the agenda for that.
The agenda today.
But not as an action item. Action. We can't take a vote on it.
You got to feel uncomfortable next month. All right. We have that all?
That's it.
Madam Chair, a quick comment. Positive one. I don't believe I shared this anecdote, but it's more for board staff and then those that are serving on the licensing committee. I was in a meeting with top-level staff in the governor's office as well as 50-plus members of the business community. And in the course of their presentation, they could have picked a number of boards or commissions to praise, and I want you to know that they praised specifically our board, not because of my presence, not because of any questioning on my behalf, but simply, you know, some of the things that is being done in the licensing our portion, they take pride in, and so I want to just note that for staff and as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Any other future agenda items? We have that. All for public comment. So this would be the time if there's anybody in the audience that wishes to address the board. We can't take action or engage in a dialogue, but if there's anything that anybody wishes to come forward and present to the board, we would give you up to 5 minutes to do so. Right, well,
I have a public comment. I want to thank the public members for being here. I'm not sure why you do this, but I appreciate it. And I appreciate the insight you guys bring on cases. And so thank you for being here.
And then you wish to address the board? All right, please come forward. And again, we can't take action on anything or give feedback, but if you would introduce yourself, and then you have up to 5 minutes.
Bradley Andrews, licensed associate marriage and family therapist. First off, I thank you for the time for the 5 minutes, partially because it's close to the three hours for the CEUs at the top of the hour here. So just wanting to round up once we get there. But first off, just thank you guys so much for the being able to have the discussion and just being able to see part of the process that's going on and the changes that are being made in the state of Arizona when it comes to the Board of Behavioral Health. I will say back when first getting going through the process, it was a very daunting task, but over the past couple of years, I have noticed a change as far as the communication, the ability to be able to dialogue with the Board of Behavioral Health rather than just wondering what's going on at times. So I do appreciate all the hard work and the change within this past decade, especially doing the procedures and different things as far as bills. As far as dialogue, when it comes to just the review as, of all the materials, I appreciate the transparency as well on going towards the, I think we said 21st century, with getting things online and easily accessible, as well as continuing to strengthen the dialogue between the licensees and the board as well. So just continue up the hard work, and I really appreciate that.
Thank you. Can you spell your last name?
Oh, Andrews, A-N-D-R-E-W-S, and
gotcha.
L-A-M-F-T. You guys will see my renewal here shortly.
Thank you so much. Any other public comments? All right. We are going into, well, we are in holiday season. Our next meeting is December 10th. So I know this is when people are making other plans. Ms. Zavala, do you have confirmation that we'll have quorum as of right now?
We do. The only one that's not going to be here at this time is Dr. Bailey. Everybody else and to be with you. And it will be a full agenda.
Well, I don't know that we can operate without Dr. Bailey. We
can.
Okay, for one.
I mean, it's going to be a struggle, but we're going to have to do that. if you can't make it, something comes up, please let Ms. Zavala know as soon as possible. I want to make sure that we can move forward. There's nothing else. Is there a motion to adjourn?
Davis moves it.
Potter second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.